This is lecture number 10, Foundations of Apologetics. God, Evil, and Suffering is the title. The general outcome. We want to understand the problem of evil and God's role in pain and suffering. We want to understand the problem of evil and God's role in pain and suffering. Specifically, we want to come to these things here. We want to understand, uncover, and show. We want to understand the myth that the problem of evil is only for theists. We want to understand the myth that the problem of evil is only for theists. We want to uncover the presumption of good behind the question itself. We want to uncover the presumption of good behind the question itself. And third and finally, we want to show how the very question of the problem of evil presupposes the existence of a moral lawgiver. We want to show how the very question of the problem of evil presupposes the existence of a moral lawgiver. So understand the myth that the problem of evil is only for theists. Uncover the presumption of good behind the question. And show how the very question of the problem of evil presupposes the existence of a moral lawgiver. And last week we looked at in depth at the science, or at science from a historical, philosophical, and really an evidential vantage point. Particularly, we focused on questions that people inevitably ask. What are we all here for? What is the point of living? How did everything begin? These are all questions that people at one time or another ask. And so it really led us to the discovery of a belief, a credulous belief, I would even say, that science or scientism can explain every aspect of the human experience. And there are limits to science. We talked about that. And lecture 9 is one of the more difficult lectures because it deals with so many heavy-duty concepts. And it's hard to navigate through it, but we did it nonetheless. But we need to understand, at the end of the day, science can't explain every aspect of our life. It simply can't. It has a quality to it that is helpful for us here in the physical world, but we're more than what we see in the mirror. And in 2012, it was Ravi Zacharias, he posted an article, and it really had to do with, he pointed it towards the atheistic community. And in this article, he begins to ask questions. And one of the questions that he asked was this. He goes, "I would ask the atheists, how is it that they defend moral reasoning in an amoral universe that occurred or originated by non-moral origins? How could all of that have arrived at the kind of thinking, or how could we have arrived at moral thinking with non-moral beginnings? How did we get there? How did we start from just strict materialism, an amoral universe, a universe without morals? How did we get from there, all right, to where we are now? If it is just strictly materialism, if it's just strictly an amoral universe, how did that come into existence? By non-moral origins. And how can all of that produce morality? How can that produce reasoning in the human being today?" And so when you think about that, the burden of proof really isn't on us. The burden of proof is really on them. They're in a bind. And so last week we looked at that and we discussed it, and so much more could have been said about that. But today we want to deal with this, the other side of the coin, so to speak. And we'll start with a quote by a man by the name of Andrew Fletcher. He is a political activist. He's of Scottish descent. This is what he said. He said, "Let me write the songs of a nation. I don't care who writes its laws. Let me write the songs of a nation. I don't care who writes its laws." What is he saying? He is basically pointing out that musicians or songwriters, when they write about these things, they are touching an area that really has impacted all of us. And what is that area? Evil and suffering. You know, years ago, I didn't really understand what it meant, but, you know, country songs, sad songs. You play the record backwards, you get your dog back, you get your wife back, get your car back, you know, and I was just like, and then it finally dawned on me. I don't know if you're a country music fan. I'm not, but that's okay. But these songwriters, they write about things that deal exclusively with emotion. They deal with suffering. They deal with the evil that is in the world. Another person wrote, another man, you're familiar with what he's written. It says, "O Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out to you violence and you will not save. Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to see trouble? For plundering and violence are before me. There is strife and contention arises. Therefore, law is powerless and justice never goes forth." You know that to be Habakkuk, chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. And so we're going to start off very carefully this morning as we walk towards this whole idea of God, evil, and suffering. You need to remember this. Whenever a skeptic or an atheist raises a question regarding evil and suffering, inevitably they are defending something or attacking something. Whenever they raise the question regarding evil and suffering, they're either defending or attacking something. Habakkuk was no atheist. You're not an atheist. But the problem of evil is still here and it's present. And as one person said, it seems to be more of a more of a mystery than a problem. A guy by the name of Gabriel Marcel, he said, "A mystery is a problem that encroaches upon itself because the questioner becomes the object of the question." What does that mean? It means this: when one is dealing with evil and suffering, it's when you talk about it, it kind of falls back on you because you're involved in it. When you and I talk about the problem of evil, It kind of falls back on us because we're involved in this thing called life. And so the problem of evil, it almost seems mysterious. Peter Kreeft, on a lighter note, he said, "Getting to Mars is a problem, falling in love is a mystery." And when he said that, I started thinking, you know, it's probably true to a certain extent, but there's more to this issue than just what we see in society. And if we look at this issue today, apart from, I guess, feeling our way in and through this, we're going to miss something. We're going to become heartless when we deal with people. And we really can't afford to do that. You know, somebody had mentioned a long time ago, there's like, you know, if your objective is to preach and teach to hurting people, you will always have an audience. And that really is the case. If I were to ask you individually of the suffering and the evil that has touched your life, I mean, we could be here for a very, very long time. And adding up the years that we are old in here, that would take us at least to two centuries, you know, just experience. And that's a lot. That's a lot of experience with life. And so when you think about the collective world and you think about people, this issue has touched them. And so when the Christian comes along with their Bible in hand and coffee in the other or whatever, and they're sitting down or they come to church and people begin to ask them questions, we need to be very careful. And so we've got five issues we're going to discuss. Number one, we're going to look at the reality of evil. The reality of evil. Number two, we're going to look at the universality of evil. The universality of evil. And number three, we're going to look at the complexity of evil. The complexity of evil. And so the reality of evil, the universality of evil, the complexity of evil. Fourth, the atheist's attempt to escape evil. The atheist's attempt to escape evil. And fifth and finally, the Christian's answer to evil. The Christian's answer to evil. And so we'll deal with number one, the reality of evil. It was Scottish skeptic David Hume that said, quote, "Were a stranger to drop suddenly in this world, I would show him as a specimen of its ills, a hospital full of diseases, a prison crowded with malefactors and debtors, a field strewn with carcasses, a fleet floundering in the ocean, a nation languishing under tyranny, famine, or pestilence. Honestly, I don't see how you can possibly square with an ultimate purpose of love." The key to that statement right there is found in the last three words, purpose of love. And so when you hear something like that, where is this coming from, this statement? Which seems to be, well, yeah, there's bad things happening, but where is that coming from? Is it coming from human experience? Perhaps. But the greater question, the purpose of love, is where did David Hume get this concept of love to begin with? Where did he say, this is bad, but this is love? Where is this concept coming from? Where is the concept of love coming from that he's making a distinction with? Ask yourself the question. Take the Bible for a second and put it aside and answer this question. What is love? Yeah, it's a song. Okay. But what is love? You think about that for a moment. You've got to define it. Try defining it apart from the Bible. How do you define it? And I would even say this. If he is David Hume, a naturalist, and yes, he was, evolution, whatever, strict materialist, how do you define love within a naturalistic framework? How do you do that? How do you get that definition? That would be a very good question to ask somebody who claims to be an atheist. It's not as hard as you may think. So the reality of evil, it's there. And this man, David Hume, is stating that there's things that are bad. So that's the reality of evil. It's here. No one's denying that. And so the reality of evil, it's here. Okay, if it's here, does that mean it's everywhere? We'll deal with the second one, the universality of evil. Remember this, evil and suffering is not the problem of the Christian or the private question of the atheist. Evil and suffering is not the problem of the Christian or the private question of the atheist. It is a question and problem for every human being. Every human being. It was Buddha who used the term dukkha to describe the universal suffering of humanity. Interestingly, the entire edifice of Buddhism is built on the premise that suffering exists. The entire idea, the thing that he was promoting, the Four Noble Truths, if you please. The first one was the existence of what he called dukkha, is the first of the Four Noble Truths. The second one deals with the origin of evil or suffering. The third deals with the cessation of suffering. And fourth deals with the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Those are the Four Noble Truths. And so when we think about the universality of evil, it's not just a question or a problem or the private question or the private problem of the Christian or the non-Christian or the theist or the non-theist. It's for everyone. We need to understand this when we go into conversations with people, that they are dealing with the same headlines that we are dealing with. They are seeing the same things that we are seeing. And struggling in their mind. I mean, I don't know how people looked at, as an atheist, how they looked at the terrorist attacks. I don't know how they looked at it when the planes plunged into the building. What did they call that? What can you say about that? Is it wrong? Is it evil? We have to understand for a second here that not everyone is going to see it the way we do. But they're going to feel the effects of it and not know where to place it. Apparently Buddha, this is what he said. He goes, I have taught one thing and one thing only. Namely, dukkha and the cessation of it. He taught about suffering and how to end it. And so the universality of evil, it comes down to this. Everyone must deal with it. Everyone must deal with it. It is not the problem of the Christian or the private question of the atheist. Everyone must deal with it. So the complexity of evil. There are three main areas where this problem can be felt. Number one, the metaphysical aspect. The metaphysical aspect. And the metaphysical aspect asks this question, what is the source of my suffering? What is the source of my suffering? Number two, the physical aspect. It asks this question, how do you deal with natural disasters? How do you deal with natural disasters? And third, and finally, regarding the complexity of evil, the three main areas where it can be felt is the moral aspect, which is the question that we hear all the time. How can an all-powerful, all-loving God actually allow evil? And so the metaphysical aspect, the physical aspect, and the moral aspect. Concerning the complexity of evil, these are three main areas. Let me ask you a question. How many of you, by a show of hands, how many of you have been asked point blank that question, how can an all-powerful, all-loving God actually allow evil? How many of you have been asked that question? almost all of you. I don't think... Okay, well, let me ask you. How many of you that raised your hands were asked that by a non-Christian, a non-theist? Look at that. Okay. And so when you think about that, that question isn't just, oh, let's just pull out the card to stump the Christian. If you talk to them, if you actually engage in a conversation, there was some experience there. C.S. Lewis, by way of analogy, he uses three questions and he uses the analogy of a boat. And he asks the question, number one, how do you keep from sinking? How do you keep from sinking? Number two, how do you keep from bumping into other ships? And number three, why are you out there in the first place? Number one, how do you keep from sinking? How do you keep from bumping into other ships? And why are you out there in the first place? The moment you and I talk about the problem of evil and suffering, life itself has to be defined. The moment you and I begin to talk about evil and suffering, life itself has to be defined. And so C.S. Lewis, he asks these three questions, uses an analogy of a boat, and he says, how do you keep from sinking? That right there, that questions personal ethics. The next one, how do you keep from bumping into other ships? That right there, that questions social ethics. And the third one, why are you out there in the first place? That questions essential ethics. Okay? And so, personal ethics, social ethics, essential ethics. These are all questions that those questions ask or probe. And so we're not really going to deal with the metaphysical or the physical. We want to deal with the third, the moral aspect. We want to deal with that in particular because there is no other answer or no way to answer the question without answering why we are here in the first place. We need to answer that. In lecture number two, we established that every worldview must answer four foundational questions. Do you know what they are? What are they? That's it. Origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. And so we need to think about this. We need to remember the reality of evil. It's here. The universality of evil. It's everywhere. The complexity of evil. Okay? We're dealing with the third one, the moral aspect. Somebody told the story of a guy that was, he got lost driving, and so he's driving, and in his journey, he decides to stop. He asks this guy, hey, I need to get back to where I'm going. And the guy responds to him, sir, if that is where you are going, you don't want to start here. He was so far off the beaten path. And so what is the point? Doubting the existence of God is not the place to start when attempting to understand the existence of evil. That's not the place to start. When somebody says there's bad things in the world, doubting that God exists is not the first place to start. That is the worst place to start, not the first. And so we see the complexity of it. Now we need to deal with the atheist's attempt to escape it. The atheist's attempt to escape it. There are three doors to choose from. Number one, the presence of evil equals no God. The presence of evil equals no God. Number two, morality without God. That's a door. Morality without God. The first door to go through, in their attempt to escape evil, they want to go through this door. The first one is the presence of evil means there's no God. So we'll go through that door. The next one is morality without God. Yeah, maybe that. We'll go through that door. And third, they go through the door. And it's really kind of a blaming door, but I'll just say this. They go through the door that says God could have always made us choose good, but it's really this requisite human goodness. You've heard of a prerequisite. You have to have this before that. Requisite human goodness means that God could have just put it in us. We would operate that way. So let's deal with that. The first one, the presence of evil equals no God. When a person says there is no such thing as evil, they are assuming there is such a thing as good. You need to own that part. When a person says there is such a thing as evil, rather, they're assuming there is such a thing as good. When a person says there is such a thing as good, they are assuming there is such a thing as a moral law on which to differentiate between good and evil. And when a person says there is such a thing as a moral law, they must posit or assume there is a moral lawgiver, which is precisely the thing that they're trying to disprove. So when someone says that's evil, well, you're assuming there's good. And if you're assuming there's good and evil, you're assuming there's a moral law. And if you're assuming there's a moral law, there must be a moral lawgiver. And the very thing that you're trying to disprove, you just proved. Okay? That's not playing games with someone. That's just being honest, logical. Embedded within the problem or mystery of evil is objectivity. Objectivity. What does that mean? It means that if evil is objectively evil, then good is objectively good. If evil is objectively evil, then good is objectively good. In other words, if it's a real thing, evil, then good has to be equally as real. And if it's equally as real on both sides, you need something with which to differentiate, which means there is a moral law somewhere. And if there's a moral law, someone gave it, because it just didn't come out of the ground. Because again, naturalism, getting a bit ahead of myself, doesn't breed morality. And as we said from the quote from Ravi in an article in 2012, how did they get from that non-moral, amoral, to a moral being called the human? Again, this is a huge problem for them. We need to think through that. If evil is objectively evil, good is objectively good, which means there are objective moral values. You've just made the case for there being objective moral values. We need a definition of a moral law. A moral law is that which is true for all places, all times, and all people. A moral law or a moral absolute is true for all places, all times, and all people. All places, all times, and all people. It's wrong to murder here. It's wrong to murder in China. It's wrong to steal in China. It's wrong to steal in Greenland. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's a moral absolute. It's wrong to murder now. It was wrong to murder in Genesis chapter 4. It's just wrong. Okay? And so we need to understand that. All times, all places, and all people. Whether they believe it or not. Whether they believe it or not. I don't believe that. That means it's okay. That doesn't change. That doesn't change anything. We need to understand something here. Listen carefully. This is very important to grasp. It is not possible to raise the question of evil without finding implicit in that question the value of personhood itself. Listen to me carefully. It is not possible to raise the question of evil without finding implicit in that question the value of personhood itself. Neither animals nor environment find fault with morality, yet they are subject to it due to the presence of humanity. Okay? you do not see on the plains the cheetah chasing the impala, the cheetah catching the impala and eating it, and then a whole gaggle of impalas coming to the lion in a court saying, that's not right. Okay? And the cheetah's saying, well, we were hungry. You don't see that. They murdered my... No, you don't see that. But what you do see is massive litigation when somebody comes in, shoots the cheetah, and takes its fur. Well, that's wrong, apparently. And so the animal world, the natural world, the environment, it does not find fault with morality, but it is subject to it because we are here. That is a very clear line between what environment and nature are and what we are. There's a very big difference. Very big difference. What does that mean? That means we have value inherently, intrinsically. There is personhood here. There is a moral being called God. There are moral beings called humans. We need to grasp that. Listen to this. The professor emeritus of philosophy at University of Calgary, Kai Nielsen, this is what he said, quote, we have not been able to show that reason requires the moral point of view, or that all really rational or any rational person should not be individual egoists or classical amoralists, I'll explain. Reason does not decide here. The picture I have painted for you is not a pleasant one. Reflection on it depresses me. Pure practical reason, even with good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to morality. What is he saying? You can't arrive at morality rationally. You arrive at it pragmatically. What is being said here? Another atheist clears it up for us. He wrote in his book, The Miracle of Theism, J.L. Mackey said, quote, we might well argue that objective, intrinsically prescriptive features, or what we call moral oughtness, you ever heard you ought not to do that? That's what he's talking about. Supervising upon natural ones constitutes an odd cluster of qualities or quantities and relations that they are most likely to have arisen or not have arisen in the ordinary course of events without an all-powerful God to create them. What are these men talking about? They're saying that morality would have never been here or been able to be recognized apart from God. This is an atheist. This is somebody who does not believe. They're recognizing this. We don't have to quote authorities in order to convince other people. Simply talk about the reality of evil, the universality of evil, the complexity of evil, and then lay out these doors for them to go through. We're dealing with the first one. We're dealing with it. And what is it? It's simply this. The presence of evil means there's no God. Really? We just talked about if somebody says that there's good or there's evil, there must be good. And then there must be a moral law to differentiate. And if there's a moral law, there's a moral lawgiver. We are well on the path of rational thought here. But it needs to be walked through carefully. Very carefully. So far, we're talking philosophically here. So far, we're looking at this topic. Okay? From just kind of like 30,000 feet, if you please. 40,000, 50,000, 100,000 in the stratosphere. We're looking down on it. Trying to get an overall. And these men are saying what they're saying, but listen to this. As you land on the planet Earth, as you land here and now you're listening to the smartest and brightest and most well-publicized people, Richard Dawkins said this, quote, in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at the bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Close quote. Think. Is that the world we live in? No. No, it's not. Do you know the poster boy, the poster girl for the postmodern relativistic mindset? You know who the poster boy is in our society? It's a sociopath. That's the perfect picture of a relativist. The highest they can go is a sociopath. You know what a sociopath is? There's somebody that just whatever they do is right, regardless if it destroys, kills, rapes, pillages. It's like, nope, it's just right to me. That's insanity. That's their poster child. They make movies about that scare you. And people go and pay to see him. Yeah, let's go watch the sociopath. Ooh, he's so evil and cunning. It's like, hello, what's going on here? It's crazy. But if you take what Mr. Dawkins said and you put it to practice with that mindset, do you know what this means? If you have that mindset, it means that Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Joseph Mengele, Pol Pot, Muammar Gaddafi, and Idi Amin Dada didn't do anything wrong. They didn't do anything wrong. It was just fine. Because after all, you know, DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is. And when everything's changing and, you know, genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. You know what? Some people are going to get lucky. And we're just dancing to the music. That's just the way it is. You know, that's just the way it is. That's it. Oh, it's just your DNA. Okay. No problem. Do you know anyone that lives like that? The people that tried living like that, they put them in a box made of metal with holes in it, and they feed them through a slot. It's called prison. You lock them in a box because they're dangerous. There you go. What they're saying is, we don't need prisons. We don't need that. Nope. You're suppressing their creativity. It's just their DNA, man. Relax. Okay. That's madness. The assumption, what they're saying, the assumption smuggles in is that the atheist would recognize, and this is interesting, they're smuggling in something. So far we've heard about all these bad things. But here's what I find it's interesting. The atheist, they recognize morality. They recognize morality. They recognize what's, I guess, good, but they deny what's bad. How is that even possible? They're saying there's no morality because they don't see it. They know what's right, but since they do not see what is right, they deny the existence of right, and their logic is faulty. So what are they saying? They're saying, okay, they're denying either together or separately either objective category. You simply cannot allow that to happen in a conversation. There's such a thing as good. Okay, what is good? There's such a thing as evil. Okay, what is evil? How do you distinguish that? Oh, it's going to get a little thicker here. You might get fired up, but that's okay. It's good for us. It's good for us. This is the first door that they're going through. The presence of evil means there's no God. That's what they're going through. And it's just, we've seen, it is completely, it's off the chart. I'm going to read you one more, then we'll take a break, and then we're going to come back and we'll have a little discussion. The next point, morality without God. Morality without God. Atheist Richard Carrier, author of Sense and Goodness Without God, maintains that there is no need for God for the following reason. He says this, quote, "It's a simple fact of direct observation that if I had the means and the power and could not be harmed for my efforts, I would immediately alleviate all needless suffering in the universe. All guns and bombs would turn into flowers. All garbage dumps would become gardens. There would be adequate resources for everyone. There would be no more children conceived than the community and the environment could support. There would be no more fatal or debilitating diseases or birth defects, no destructive, quote-unquote, acts of God. And whenever men and women seem near to violence, I would intervene and kindly endeavor to help them peacefully resolve their differences. That's what any loving person would do. Yet I cannot be more loving, more benevolent than the Christian God. Therefore, the fact that the Christian God does none of these things, in fact, nothing of any sort whatsoever, is proof positive that there is no Christian God." Close quote. This is what they're saying. And so, we're going to have a discussion about that when we come back. And so we'll pause here. See you at 10 after, and then we'll finish the balance. Think deeply.
Yeah, so all that wasn't recorded?
Yeah.
I would love to go back to it.
One of the best. I like that. I love it. I love it. For those of you listening on the tape, we just had a lively discussion. Moving on. Can I just say, I love this. I love it when students hold their ground. I love it. Because we're in this together, aren't we? We are. And we have to navigate through this. And sometimes there's, pow, pow, pow. Wait a minute.
And what about the warning of being blotted out of the book of life?
In the book of Revelation? We'll talk to that one. I love it. Should I just teach soteriology next semester?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. Here we go. All right, let's get back to this. In 1975, we're talking about the doors that the atheists try to get away from. The presence of evil equals no God. And then we talked about morality with God. We listened to Richard Carrier's idea of what he thought he would do. And basically, he's saying, if I were king for a day, he's saying, if it were all under my control, I'd do it this way. And I want you to think about this. In 1975, Harvard biologist Edward Wilson said this. He said, quote, "Scientists and humanists should consider together the possibility that the time has come for ethics to be removed temporarily from the hand of philosophers." And here's a word that's not a real word, biologicized. What is he saying? He's saying that it's time to replace and reduce ethics with biology. Do you know what bioethics is? Bioethics and biotechnology. Bioethics is like really ahead. They're asking not if we can, but if we should. There is a book by the late Chuck Colson and Nancy Piercy. It's a spinoff of the title by Francis Schaeffer, How Now Then Shall We Live? But it's Colson and Piercy's book is How Shall We Live? How Now Shall We Live? And in that book, it talks about breeding headless babies. So they're not really human, but you can use their organs. That's bioethics. They're asking the question, is that right? Is that wrong? Okay? And so he's saying this whole idea of ethics should be biologicized. This was in 1975, again, by the biologist Edward Wilson. And so the implications of this thinking simply do not square with humanity as a whole. Listen now. What he's saying doesn't square with society as a whole. There's another book in 1995. It was called Emotional Intelligence. The author is Daniel Goleman. He begins that book with the heart-stirring story of Gary and Mary Jean Chauncey, who were in the Amtrak train that went down over a bridge in swirling waters, which swallowed up many people's lives. They themselves were trapped in their compartment as they tried desperately to save the life of their 11-year-old daughter, Andrea, who was stricken with cerebral palsy and bound to her wheelchair. They succeeded in saving her life, and they did so at the cost of their own. In describing this noble act, Goleman points out that such emotionally charged moments do not give birth to impulse in a vacuum, but rather it is the outworking of a commitment to certain values and truths already made in one's life. Goleman is right in this sense. What is the most obvious in the love and commitment of these parents to their young one is that passionate commitments never stand alone. They stand on the foundation of a worldview. And so when we think about this, when we think about what those parents did, think now, the noble act, it's really what we would say, it's the quintessential example working out of a word. It's supererogatory, which means going beyond the requirement of duty. This is what's being said there. Biology cannot lead us to ethics, like that guy was saying. Biology won't lead us to ethics. It will not lead us there. Naturalism would have called Andrea's parents fools. It would have said, why would you do that? Survival of the fittest would have said they should have just swam away. Instead, the natural instinct of the rational mind and all of its nobility seeks to protect the weak, the helpless, the vulnerable. That's what we do. Somebody gave the example that when you're on a jet and you're getting in there and you're taking off and landing, they tell you if you know, we go into trouble and the oxygen thing comes out, put it on the little kid first. Or put it on yourself first, then on the little kid. It's like, wait, the first thing you want to do is protect. Why? Because they're little. I even went through that training when I was in law enforcement. You have to take care of yourself. You have to take care of yourself, not those, because if you're not helpful, then no one else will get helped. And it's like, wait a minute, it goes against. You have to be trained to not protect the weak, the helpless. You have to be told. It's interesting. And so as we're coming towards the end here, looking at the third one, requisite human goodness, meaning God could have made us always choose good. And maybe you think, yeah, that's a good idea. It seems to justify the atheists and basically blaming the condition of the world on God. But in reality, if God always made us choose to be good, we would be what's called automatons. What is an automaton? It's a robotic mechanism that self-operate without emotion, will. At this point, you should think of the Pirates of the Caribbean. That's an automaton. Okay? They just do what they do. Nobody lives life like an automaton. Nobody. One of the best-known Protestant philosophers in America, it's Alvin Plantinga. He said, God cannot do what is naturally or mutually exclusive. God cannot do what is mutually exclusive. What does that mean? God can't draw square circles. Nobody can. God does not draw square circles. God does not make married bachelors. Okay? Very common examples. If this were true, God could do whatever he wanted, which would eliminate the problem of presence of evil, but God would be made into a cosmic monster. Or as Dr. Norman Geisler says, a cosmic rapist. You cannot love without having freedom not to love. I want to give you a summation here. Door number one. Write this down. Door number one. Escaping will lead to nothing normative. Escaping will lead to nothing normative. When they say the presence of evil equals no God, going through that door, escaping will lead to nothing normative. Number two, escaping will lead to nothing noble. Nothing noble. Morality does not come out of biology. And number three, escaping will end to the illogical. escaping will end to the illogical. So you try to go through any one of those doors, one, two, or three. Escaping will lead to nothing but nothing normative, nothing noble, and everything illogical. Those are the doors that they try to run through. So here's our answer, the Christian answer to evil as we close now. The Christian answer begins with and rests in the nature and character of God. He is not only moral, he is holy. The difficulty with understanding the problem of evil lay in the fact that we do not understand the nature of holiness. God is not just calling humanity to morality. God is calling humanity to understand who he is. And who is he? He's holy. We have to turn to the Bible. God is the author of life, Genesis 1:1. Therefore, because God is the author of life, life has a storyline. Or you'll read it in some people's books, they call it a theodrama. There is a storyline. God's purpose and desire for all humanity has been for us to be in relationship with him. So we're coming down and we're going to talk about that whole question here. God's desire for all humanity has been for us to be in relationship with him. When humanity turned their backs on him, discord broke out. Humanity was meant for what we call a covenantal love relationship celebrated in worship. That's what we were meant for. We were meant for a covenantal love relationship celebrated in worship. And if we can come close to this in the marriage picture, which Paul uses in Ephesians 5, but listen to this. The old English wedding vows used to read, and this is interesting, they used to read a line in there. It says, "With my body, I thee worship." They used to say that. "With my body, I thee worship." That's profound if you think about it. You know, what were the vows saying? It was a clear statement of consecration, separateness, exclusiveness. To step outside of those vows, the picture that God created would be instantly marred. The relationship would be degraded, and what was pure would now be profaned. The act of adultery is horrific. It's horrific. God says in Ezekiel 6 and 9, he goes, "I was crushed by their adulterous heart, which has departed from me, and by their eyes, which play the harlot after their idols." This is God speaking. What kind of effect does our sin have on him? It crushes him. It crushes him. Literally, the word crush, it means to pulverize. It means to deform. It means to break. It means to smash. It means to shatter. I was having a conversation with one of the pastors here, and as we were going through this conversation, we were just going back and forth. He said this, he goes, "You know, I'm looking at this particular passage in the Bible. In John chapter 13, Jesus comes down, and he gets literally physically lower than Peter. He's washing his feet." He goes, "I'm thinking, God, that's what you're doing. You're coming to serve us." That's love. The love that God has for us is incomprehensible. It's a category. It's the distinct other, because God is the distinct other. We don't understand that kind of love. Here's the crazy thing. Look at the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7. When you look at that, at the end of that sermon, he says, "Judge not, lest you be judged." Why would God put it at the end? Why would Jesus put it at the end? Because he knows people. He gives the perfect marching orders, but then he says, "Oh, by the way, don't kill each other with this. Don't judge each other. Be nice." Because he knows our tendency. New believers typically take the scripture and they're legalists. "Oh, that's not right. Oh, that's not right. Oh, that's not right." They haven't been forgiven enough to know how to love. Is that biblical? Indeed it is. Those who have been forgiven much, what? Love much. Those who have been forgiven little, love little. Now here's the funny thing. The Pharisees didn't know that God wanted to forgive them. Now, they didn't think they had a sin. He goes, "Since you say you see, you're blind. Because you say you see, but you're blind. And since you say you see, your sin remains." Whoa. Isn't that crazy? That's Jesus. Heavy duty. Listen to this. It was Jean-Paul Sartre who said, "The man who wants to be loved does not desire the enslavement of the beloved. He is not bent on becoming the object of passion, which flows forth mechanically. He does not want to possess an automaton. And if we want to humiliate him, we need try to only persuade him that the beloved's passion is the result of a physiological determinism. The lover will then feel that both his love and his being are actually cheapened. If the lover is transformed into an automaton, the lover finds himself alone, close quote. He was an atheist. You know what he's saying? He's saying if we're all automatons, we're really alone. There's no relationship. We're just mechanically carrying things out. Can you imagine marrying a man, marrying a woman? They're just programmed to love. I'll take that one. Programmed to love. There's no relationship. It's just there. This is what they do. And so your love towards them, it's like it doesn't even matter. And so think about this. Practically, the world of reality is a world of pain. God not only chooses to love us, he expresses his love in the cross of Jesus Christ. Jesus embodied both the destructiveness of evil and the cost by showing first what it was to face suffering without deserving it. He was innocent. He was innocent. When I think about this, the Christian answer is as follows. Number one, God is the author of life. God is the author of life. Number two, life has a storyline. Creation, fall, and redemption. Okay? Number three, the storyline is worship and love. Number four, the heart of love is expressed in the cross of Christ, Jesus. Number five, the cross of Jesus Christ does not point to evil outside, it points to evil within. Now listen carefully. Picking up our discussion now. This is worth the whole lecture. When you, when I look out at the world, and the greatest example of sin and evil is anything but our own human heart, we have become self-righteous. Do you hear me? When you look out at the world and the example of sin, the example of wrongdoing lands on someone other than your own evil human heart, you've become self-righteous. I'm not as bad as them. You're a Pharisee. I would never do that. You're delusional. I've never done that. In other words, when I look at my life and I look at the life of Christ, I realize that I'm a sinner. Now can you see the power in that scene where Jesus says there stood a Pharisee? I don't do this. I don't do that. I don't do the other. And then the tax collector, not even willing to look up to heaven, says, "Oh Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner." And what did Jesus say? That guy went down justified. Justified. And oh, we love that illustration. Just as if I'd never sinned. We need to think about that, don't we? Are you having a good day because you didn't sin? Or are you having a good day because you have a sinless Savior? Do you measure the productivity of your Christian life based upon your sinlessness? I didn't do this. I didn't do that. Wow. My goodness, you must be perfect. Years ago, the advice was given to me. You cannot convince people that you're a great preacher and God is a great Savior. Take your pick. Christ projection must win the day over self projection. Get yourself out of that passage. Thank you, Dad. I appreciate that. I never forgot it. We need to think about that, don't we? When we talk about evil in the world, we need to start with our own hearts. And the last time I checked, the sweet singer of Israel said, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me." And then at the end, he says, "O Lord, search me and know me. And try me and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." He never got over it. He never got over it. And so the question now comes to this. Can a carnal Christian go to heaven? Yes. Yes. Have you been carnal? How many times does it take you to be carnal? One time. The more clearer question, the better way to look at it, is that clever little jingle. Christians aren't sinless, but they do sin less over time. The direction, not the perfection of their life. Do you realize we're being perfected? Do you realize that the powerful verse in Jude, "Now unto him who is able to present you before his presence with exceeding joy, faultless." He's able to present you before his presence faultless. What does that mean? That means as long as we're here on this earth, we are sinners being sanctified. Do you want what's right? Yes. Do you do what's right? Okay. What I want to do, I don't do. What I don't want to do, that I do. Oh, wretched man that I am. Think about it. God is so merciful now, bringing it down and landing this. What makes us want to sin? What makes us want to sin? The sin nature, yeah. What can defeat the sin nature? The new nature, Romans 8. By the power of the Spirit, you put to death the deeds of the flesh, right? And then answering the question of abiding. There is an interesting Greek word. It is paresteme. And it says, present your bodies as instruments of righteousness. Present, paresteme. It means to place yourself close to God. Therein is the beauty of abiding. But how do we abide? By the power of the Spirit. Do you see? And so my spiritual maturity becomes an accumulation, doesn't it, of my times of walking in the Spirit. But how many of you know that God is able to take what's completely broken, break it further, use it, and it works perfect? That's God. He buys what's completely broken at full price. That's what he did to us. And so when we think about this, when we think about this, we quickly dismiss religion. We dismiss it. The beauty of relationship. We'll go ahead and pause here and pray. And then we'll talk more.